Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today I'm on location, we could say, at Virginia Commonwealth University. I'm going to be doing a few programs up here, and the first one is going to be with a professor from psychology. Her name is Professor Danielle Dick, and she does all sorts of things with DNA and, you know, the genome, and how does that come about, and why am I interested? So Danielle Dick is going to tell us what she does with these sorts of analyses at Virginia Commonwealth University. So Danielle, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Tell us, before we get into the utility of doing this type of analysis on spittle, or that's what I did, I spat into a tube, or other methodologies, how did you become a scientist in the first place? Way back, before you knew what a genome was, were you interested in science?
That's such a great question. I always talk to my undergrads about this because they have this idea that there's a straight path to finding what you're meant to do in life. And I did the old school, went to college with no real idea what I wanted to do. My dad was a fighter pilot and my mom stayed home with us. And I knew I didn't want to do either of those things. So they encouraged me to take a lot of classes and see what I loved. I was pre-med, like I think everyone else who's undecided there at the University of Virginia, where I did my undergraduate degree. And I took a psychology class and became fascinated really by the brain as the last frontier of medicine and how little we knew compared to so many other areas and just the fascinating questions behind why some people are more likely to develop problems with alcohol and other people can drink socially without it taking over their lives, and why some people are more likely to become depressed than others or hear voices. And so I was taking a genetics class and I was taking the psychology class, and my advisor was wise enough to say, you know, I think you should go talk to this professor, Irv Gottesman, who I kept in touch with until he passed away last year, but was one of the world's leading experts on the genetics of schizophrenia, and started doing research with him, and the rest was history. I stayed in academia ever since.
And as a child then, you said your father was an Air Force pilot, so you roamed around the world a little bit? You went to school in different countries?
Absolutely, yes. I was born in Germany. My sister was born in England. My brother was born in California. We moved about every year or other year, all growing up. So I threw my fair share of temper tantrums about how my parents were ruining my life by uprooting me every year, but I can look back now and say that it was really an amazing experience to get to live and experience the culture of so many places around the world and across the United States as well.
I mean, I see lots of students, so they call themselves, I think, well, you called yourself a military brat. I mean, it doesn't sound like a good term, but in fact, these students have a world experience that most students don't get, and so it's a great advantage to them.
It's also great exposure therapy in the sense that so many things in life are about trying new things, right? If you're a scientist and you're going to a conference and you have to go to that reception when you don't know anyone or those sorts of things, and I had been doing that my whole life, being thrown into situations where I didn't know folks, I didn't know a town, and learning to meet new people and explore what there was to do there. And so I think those are actually really great life skills that I probably would not have sought out, but were put upon me and really, I think, have been good for me personally, also probably professionally as well.
Well, that's good. So then finally, you got a degree, an undergraduate degree in psychology, and then you decided to, hey, I like it. Let's carry on. Let me discover something. So you became a graduate student.
And I did.
And what did you learn? What did you discover? Let me put it that way. Your first sort of exposure into research.
So my undergraduate degree was in psychology and biology, and then I went to work with Dick Rose at Indiana University. And one of the things that really attracted me to that program was that he was the United States counterpart who collaborated closely on the Finnish twin studies. And the reason that he was doing research in Finland was we were studying the development of alcohol use and problems in adolescents and young adults. And there's nothing special about alcohol use in Finland per se, but Finland has a central population registry. So we were able to identify all twins born in the country during a certain period. We were looking at 5-year increments, and then it's also a law that you have to keep your address updated with the government. So we could, we knew who they were and we could find them. And when we would just send questionnaires out in the mail, we would get 90% response rates. So you could do this amazing epidemiological research in ways that we simply couldn't do in the United States.
Well, why do you think they're so quiescent and fill in all the forms? I'm sure I don't. And I'm sure you don't.
Yes,
I mean, we get so many of these as an educator, as a scientist, to help better you prepare for your students or prepare you. And I get tired of them.
Absolutely. And I've had these conversations with the Finns. And I think it's a product of a couple of things. One, they have an amazing healthcare system. And it's a social democracy. So there's healthcare provided for all. And so there's very much a sentiment that, why wouldn't you participate in biomedical research? Because it will advance knowledge and that will come back to benefit you. And the other piece is that Finland is a young country, obviously, with a history of other countries, particularly Russia, essentially controlling it. So the idea that when you talk to older Finns, in founding the country, it was really an opportunity to create a country that was the way they wanted it. And so there's this tremendous sense of giving back as well. And I will tell you that our response rates with the younger generations and with especially now the European Union and the flow of people more readily between borders, that our response rates have actually gone down just a bit, but they're still exceedingly high compared to the United States, where we are just inundated and there's a very different attitude toward participation and research.
Well, yeah, but we'll come back to that in a minute. But I was just wondering if you, I've heard the same idea about this sort of uniformity and this great ability to get data from Iceland. That's another society. And that one is even, in a sense, much less troubled by intermarriages from strangers, if I could put it that way.
Exactly. Finland, Iceland, the Scandinavian countries, both because of their population registries, but in addition, because of the homogeneity of the population, which makes it a great place to do genetic research. Because the United States, for example, where there's been lots of admixing, it's far harder to do genetic research because there's simply so much more genetic variability. So if you're trying to find genes, there's likely more genes and more genetic variants that are involved in differences in health outcomes in the United States, where there's a big diverse population with lots of ancestral backgrounds, than someplace like Finland or Iceland. So it makes it much easier to track and find genes involved in health outcomes, which is another reason that we do research over there.
Well, you could also add to that, there's a certain suspicion, I think, in the United States of giving away too much information about yourself, right? Will it come back to haunt you? Will they suddenly find there's a little genetic trait that makes you a little suspicious in social behavior? And so how does that going to affect your future? I mean, do you come across that here?
There is definitely a different attitude in the United States and in Finland. So in the United States, certainly the attitude that you just discussed, more concern about Big Brother, right? And what would this, how might this information get used? We go to great pains in all of our projects here in the United States to make sure that there is confidentiality, that the data is protected, that it can't be accessed by others, et cetera. But there's still that concern. Whereas in Finland, I recall years ago we were talking about potentially initiating a project where we could look at adolescents' movements and by their cell phones and by use of public transportation. And my advisor, Dick Rose, and I from the United States were laughing and saying, wow, you could never do that in the United States. The idea that you were being, your movements were being tracked by your cell phone. And the Finns are looking at us kind of funny and saying, I just don't understand the concern, because aren't the people who would be worried about that people who would be up to something that you'd want them to be the ones that the government was tracking, right? Either this ability to track could be beneficial for things like lost children. It you know, could allow you to, in fact, find people who had done things they weren't supposed to, crimes, et cetera. And so it's just such a different mentality and relationship, I think, candidly, between a people and their government that that is interesting, you know, for socio-political reasons, but also really changes the climate and our ability to do research. So you started asking about some of the things that we found, and really our ability to use these big population registries and to track an entire cohort of kids. So we were studying about 5,000 kids in each of these two studies, so about 10,000 kids total, and follow them from early adolescence through young adulthood. We've been able to find things like the importance of one's genetic predisposition changes tremendously over time. So, for example, if you're trying to understand what influences drinking patterns in young adolescents, it's almost all environmentally influenced, which makes sense because for kids to be drinking or drinking heavily, it requires an environment. It requires access to alcohol. But as people move to kind of through experimentation and adolescents kind of move into somewhat regular patterns of drinking, that's when you see genetic predispositions really tipping the balance, and they become the most influential thing impacting how much kids are drinking, far more so than their environments. So those are some of the kind of things that we were able to do by studying a whole population of kids followed across this really important developmental phase.
Well, let's pursue that just a little more, because you talked about twin studies. And, you know, from what little I know, the twin studies have always been one of those fertile grounds for trying to tease out nurture versus nature. And I just wonder if you could summarize where we are today in that type of environment. Do we notice that the differences are, in fact, the younger the people are, the twins are, the more their environment is impacting their behavior, and the older they grow, the more they revert back to type?
So twins provide a beautiful natural experiment, essentially, because they come in two types of a sort, monozygotic or identical twins who are sharing all their genetic variation, and dizygotic or fraternal twins who are sharing just half of their genetic variation, just like ordinary siblings. So you can essentially compare how similar these two types of siblings being raised together in a family are, where one type, monozygotic twins, what they share above and beyond fraternal or dizygotic twins is more of their genetic variation. So if something's genetically influenced, we would assume they would be more similar. If BZ twins, on the other hand, fraternal twins, are just as similar as MZ twins, that would tell us that there must be shared environmental factors, that parenting or neighborhood or school factors, that those are the things that are predominantly important on whatever behavior you're studying. In our case, it was we looked a lot at alcohol use and conduct problems and those kind of things in kids. And so they provide this lovely experimental design. And what the last 50 years or so of twin studies have certainly taught us is that virtually all behavior is genetically influenced to some degree. So they've really revolutionized the way that we think about things, whereas, you know, so it wasn't that long ago that even severe mental illnesses like schizophrenia were considered to be the fault of mothers, right? It was poor mothering that caused these things. It was cold
these,
mothers these that
were
caused
studies,
autism.
These were studies,
right?
By fathers.
So I know mothers get blamed for everything. I know I'm one of them. I get blamed now too. But as I always say, it's my genes to blame, not my parents.
You're listening to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell from the University of Texas at El Paso, but on location at Virginia Commonwealth University, talking to Danielle Dick from the Department of Psychology, where she was talking about genetic the genetic basis of our being influencing behavior. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. Norbert, you know we have to do these once in a while, the senior episodes.
I can't even disagree with you anymore, since the aches and pains are just piling on.
So this time we're talking about retinal detachment, which can happen the older we get. The good news is there's a new gel being developed that improves the outcome of surgeries to repair torn retinas.
When light shines into our eyes, it passes through the cornea, aqueous humor, lens, and something called the vitreous body, which maintains the shape of our eyes.
The vitreous body consists of a clear jelly-like substance that transmits light to the retina in the back of the eye. It also presses on the retina to keep it together.
With age, the vitreous can start to liquefy and lose structure, which pulls on the retina, risking a tear and detachment. The problem with existing treatment is that it replaces the vitreous body with either a gas or oil, but each carries its own complications.
The new gel, however, seems to be biocompatible and retains vision. They start with two types of star-shaped polymers, each with a unique reactive chemical group on the ends.
In separate reactions, they allow both polymers to start the reactions to create a gel, but stop the process before it's complete. They then mix the two types of polymers together, injecting them into rabbit eyes, and let the polymerization go to completion.
The rabbit's repaired retina stayed attached for over 400 days. Not only were there no side effects, the gel didn't alter vision. They still need to work out issues such as whether the gel is easily removable and will remain stable and clear for years.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Daniel Dick from VCU Department of Psychology. So the business about aging then, so the younger, even in the twin studies, the younger the what would I call the people being studied, the more likely they are to be environmentally impacted compared to the older they progress. Is that a truism?
That's certainly true for substance use, but it also generalizes to many other kinds of behaviors. So even things like intelligence and cognitive ability and those sorts of things, many things that have been studied, there's stronger evidence for environmental influences early on, and that makes sense, right? Parents are able to control many aspects of their kids' environment. As we get older, we increasingly have the freedom and the flexibility and autonomy to be able to select into certain environments, which so our genotypes are influencing the environments that we choose, and both our genetic predispositions have more opportunity to express themselves as we have more choice and control over our behavior. So I would say as kind of a general rule of thumb, yes, that does tend to be true, that environmental influences are important earlier in life, but particularly as people move into adulthood, genetic predispositions become increasingly important.
Okay, that's good to know. So I'm beyond the early stage. So whatever I do now is basically because my genes tell me to do it. This is great.
I'm going to qualify that, which is one of the things that actually my group and several others do a lot of work on, is how the environment can change the importance of one's genetic predisposition. So genes are predispositions. They dispose us towards certain behaviors and outcomes, but they aren't destiny. And so one of the things, a kind of example of this in studying substance use, I think makes it easy to wrap one's head around, is that we all carry different genetic variants that put us more or less at risk of developing problems with, say, alcohol or other drugs. But if for some reason a drug was completely removed from our environment, it didn't exist, or perhaps we're somewhere where it's illegal and not accessible, et cetera, it would not matter what our genotypes were.
Well, in the absence of the input, I understand that, yes.
Yes, but there's many things, many environments that can shift the likelihood that even if we're genetically predisposed to something, we'll actually have that outcome or display that problem. So there are many environments that also can shift the that likelihood.
Let me just follow up on that just a little, because somewhere along the line, we've had other people talking about things they call risk factor. And, you know, there is a certain genetic makeup of people that is more prone to take risks, be more adventurous in taking inappropriate substances, maybe I put it that way. I mean, are we very close to being able to say, we see this little piece of the genome and this is associated with people who really take a lot of risks compared to others?
For substance use and psychiatric outcomes, we are certainly still a long way from being able to identify all of the genes and understand the underlying biology and mechanisms behind why some people are more at risk than others. That said, what we do know is that these risk factors or these risky predispositions for substance use, they show up in many forms, one of which you were just talking about. Some of us, we all vary in how impulsive we are, right? And impulsivity has lots of dimensions too. We vary in how much we like reward. We vary in how risk-taking we are. We vary in how much we dislike consequences, right? Like how conscientious we are. All of these things can impact the likelihood that someone is going to try substances, like the way that they feel, and want to keep using them and potentially use them in risky ways. So we know something about what these predispositions are, these genetically influenced predispositions are, even absent having found all of the actual genes that are involved yet.
Let me change subjects here a little bit, because I noticed on your website you've got this very nice piece of advice. I call it advice, and it simply says, spit for science. Why don't you tell us about what this program is, and why should we spit for science?
Yes, yeah, so this is a big project that I run at VCU, and it's a university-wide opportunity for all of our incoming freshmen to be a part of this big project, Spit for Science, which is focused on how we can really all come together to better understand genetic and environmental influences on substance use and other behavioral health outcomes. And so what we do is we invite all the incoming freshmen to complete a survey when they show up on campus. So it's essentially, tell us about you and how you're doing when you get here at university. And then after they do the survey, we compensate them for their time. And they also have the option of, at that point, of spitting, hence the spit in Spit for Science, to be a part of the DNA component. Because we use this as an opportunity to really raise awareness about substance use and mental health outcomes really in our society, as well as in young people, where these are the biggest health risk factors for this age group, this emerging adulthood age group, and about to raise awareness about how health outcomes, virtually all health outcomes, are a product of our genetic predispositions and our environments and how they come together. And so this project is really about understanding those things across the college years. So we ask them to complete a survey when they show up on campus, and then we invite them to complete follow-up surveys every spring thereafter. And so the idea is to both contribute to the gene-finding piece, where we know we need huge numbers of individuals to be able to find genes, and they can be a part of that discovery process of science. And then what we're looking at is what kinds of environments also reduce risk among our students who might be genetically at risk for different outcomes.
Well, let me hang on, if I could interrupt one moment there.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, to do this, you need to get the DNA analysis, and that's not cheap. I mean, I think my wife paid $100 for my little finding of being European. Do you?
Yes.
What do you get money for every single student that volunteers? That's got to be a big chunk of change.
So the project has been funded through a variety of sources. It is funded, it's been funded through the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. It's been funded through internal funds, through VCU. But you are right that it is running a large-scale project like this is expensive, and we are, in fact, always trying to raise funds both privately and through foundations and through the National Institutes of Health to be able to continue this project. And a big part of it is also feeding the results back to our students and our community. So I am a big believer that that we are very fortunate when people contribute to and participate in science. And I think as scientists, we need to do a better job of really engaging the public in the process of science, which also means not just presenting the findings to other scientists, but we work with our faculty in the School of the Arts. We have a top-ranked School of the Arts at VCU with faculty over in our mass communication journalism areas on how can we give research findings back in creative and interesting ways, both to our participants, our students, and to use those findings to benefit the programming, the policy that we put in place at the university to support the behavioral and emotional health of our students.
When you get all of this data, you must surely sometimes be able to see important things, not just to do with addiction, abusive substances, etc., but maybe predisposition to certain disease. Do you come across that very often, and how do you deal with that?
So we are actually very explicit with our students that we are not doing any sort of clinical genetic testing of the sort that you're talking about, and of the sort that individuals can get commercially through, for example, 23andMe and other kinds of companies. So we are very upfront with the students that this is essentially about contributing to basic science in areas that we don't yet fully understand or have clinically actionable results. So while we can essentially create genetic risk scores to be able to study them in our projects, they are not yet sufficiently predictive to be able to give an individual information back that would essentially be extremely accurate information about their own personal risk for substance use or the mental health kind of outcomes that are the focus of this project.
Okay, so that's a decision that you've made based upon the fact that you're not so clear that it's indicative of what may be in the future. I mean, that's just something that you're trying to determine.
Well, we're not there
yet. Right.
Exactly, and that's really one of the things that we talk with the students about is that we don't know yet. We don't know what the underlying biology of addiction and of other mental health outcomes is. So they can be a part of that discovery process, but we don't yet really have any clinically relevant information to give back to them at this point.
So we've got to finish up our program here, but can I just go back to then Finland? In Finland, do they have indeed, though, a much more robust predictive tool, and that they do in fact use this to give the Finnish people who have participated some clues as to whether or not they're liable to be predisposed to certain disease? Do they do that?
Not in our research settings. So this is actually a very active area of conversation in science, because essentially as genetics is becoming successful, it raises this very question that you're asking about, which is really, at what point do you start giving individuals back their genetic information? Right now, that still has to happen through federal FDA-approved products like 23andMe or through a doctor's office. But research settings are actually kept separate, because the idea is that in research settings, you're still doing exploratory, discovery-based science. But the hope is that it won't be too far in the future before this does increasingly become clinically relevant, and then we will be able to give information back.
Well, jolly good. That's a very fascinating program, an important topic, because I think that as we get into the future, and as you point out, these techniques become more and more rigorous, and we will, in fact, have to deal with the ethical aspects of telling people what we found. But we're not there yet, apparently. So, Daniel Dick, thank you so much. Department of Psychology, Virginia Commonwealth University. It's been a great pleasure having you on Science Studio.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I'd like to thank Lauren Terrazas for producing this program, and you, the listener, for being there. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.